This week's scripture comes from Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and verse 10. Many of you are probably somewhat familiar with that scripture. That scripture says, "Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going." Now some have tried to make this verse out to indicate that there's not life after death, or that the dead don't know where they are, or any of those kinds of things. And that's not the point that Solomon is making in this passage. He's simply saying that whatever you're going to do, you better get it done in this life. Because when you go to the grave, there's no working anymore. There'll be no tools in the grave for you to make anything or do anything. There's not going to be any additional knowledge. Xander, sit down. There's not going to be anything else that's going to give you any additional knowledge or any additional wisdom when you die that isn't available to you, all that you need to get to heaven or to do any of the things that it's necessary for us to do. Those things aren't going to occur after we die. Now, true, when we get to heaven, hopefully, I know I say hopefully, I hope to know a whole lot more about a lot of things than I know now. But as far as the knowledge that's necessary to get there, there's nothing that we're going to find in the grave. It's all here for us now, and we need to make the effort to reach our full potential in this life. Because there's no more chance after this. So we want to focus on this aspect of this verse. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. A lot of times we say, do it with all your might. But we need to do it 100%. Now, obviously, the Bible author here, who we know as God, is not talking about sinful things. God would never tell us to do sinful things with all our might. It's sad that we have to say that, but we do. Because some people, you know, I'm really good at stealing things. And so I tell you what, a lot of people in the criminal world, they do it with all their might. I mean, they go, if they would work half as hard at a legitimate job as they do at those criminal activities, they could change the world. They could find that cure for cancer. They could manage to figure out how to get a rocket ship to Mars. They could, you know, all these things that people struggle with, these guys could figure it out if they put their mental abilities and desire toward doing something profitable rather than the crime that they're committing. But we need to understand that, of course, that Solomon, when he writes this, he's referring to us doing things that are of a good nature. But we need to do it fully with all our might. As we begin, I want to consider this poem. I knelt to pray when day was done, and pray, Lord bless everyone. Lift from each heart the pain, and let the sick be well again. And then I woke again one day, and carelessly went on my way. The whole day long I did not try to wipe a tear from any eye. I did not try to share the load of any brother on the road. I did not even go to see the sick man just next door to me. Yet once again, when day was done, I prayed, Lord bless everyone. But as I prayed, to my ear came a voice that whispered, dear, pause, hypocrite, before you pray. Whom have you tried to bless today? God's sweetest blessings always go by hands that serve Him here below. And then I hid my face and cried, forgive me, Lord, for I have lied. Let me but live another day, and I will live the way I pray. Now, how many times do we pray for God to do something that we could easily do, and we don't take a step in that direction? We need to work to make sure that we're doing those things that God wants us to do, those things that we want God to accomplish, that we're doing everything to ensure that they get accomplished. The saying has often been said that God has no hands here on earth but our hands, no feet but our feet, no mouths but our mouths. We are the ones who are here to act on His behalf. The time of His miraculous works is gone. And if anything's going to be accomplished, it's going to have to be accomplished by Christians. God's not going to send down angels to destroy a city like He did at Sodom and Gomorrah. He's not going to show miraculous works like He did when He led the children of Israel out of Egypt. He's not going to do those things. He expects us to take the message and to show the world. And of course, how important it is for us to have knowledge. Zeal without knowledge, or on the other hand, how important it is for us to have that zeal. On the other side of that is knowledge without zeal. Either of those are detrimental, in fact, dangerous combinations. Romans 10, 1 through 3, Paul says, "Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they may be saved. For I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. For they, being ignorant of God's righteousness and seeking to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted to the righteousness of God." So these folks had zeal, but they didn't have the knowledge to go along with it. Just as dangerous. And many times what we are more guilty of is having the knowledge. We know what's right. We know what we ought to do. We know what God's commanded. But we don't have the zeal, the desire, the energy to do it. That's just as detrimental to the church as those who go out without the knowledge. And they're out there zealously drawing people away from the truth. And here I sit with the truth, but not doing anything to bring anybody to the truth. We're both working to hinder the cause of Christ when we do those things. So we've got to watch out. We need to make sure that we have both the knowledge and the zeal. Sometimes we fail to recognize our own laziness. We can easily point it out in someone else. We can say, "Oh, so-and-so never does anything except sit around and talk and gossip and watch TV. They never get out and do anything," as we gossip about them while we're sitting around doing nothing. It's easy to point out that somebody else is this way. We've got to find these things in ourselves. There is a great temptation within all of us toward laziness. Now, many have got that under control, and they are busy and working, but some of us really struggle to want to do anything. And we need to watch out for that. We sometimes may not even recognize it. We have so many excuses for why we don't accomplish the things that we set out to do. Anything from, it was just too hard, or it was too much, or any number of other things, none of the common complaints that we hear sometimes. I just didn't feel good. Didn't feel good. Well, we don't have to feel good to do the things that we need to do. One of the things that we have to learn is that even when we don't feel good, we still have obligations that we have to meet. Proverbs 26:13-16. The lazy man says, "There's a lion in the road. A fierce lion is in the street. As a door turns on its hinges, so does the lazy man on his bed. The lazy man buries his hand in the bowl, and it wearies him to bring it back to his mouth. The lazy man is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can answer sensibly." Sometimes we get so caught up in ourselves that we think we've got all the answers and we don't think we have to do anything. And look at the excuses. Well, there's a lion in the road. I can't go to... How many excuses that are just about that good have you heard? Well, there's this or there's that. I can't go out there. I can't do this. I can't do that because what if this happens? That's just an excuse for us to give to be lazy. And we've got to watch out for that. The writer of Ecclesiastes tells us that when we find something that needs to be done, something to do, we need to go to it. We need to get to it and work at it and do it with all our might until that problem is accomplished. I know I'm guilty of this. How many of you are? How many of you have started a particular project and never finished it? You ever done that? And I do that near about every day. I start on something and then 6 months later, I go, oh, yeah, when did I start that? I didn't get very far on that project. We need to follow these things through to the end. When he talks about do it with your mind, he doesn't just mean put a whole bunch of energy into it for 5 minutes. He means follow it through to the end. Finish the project. It's so easy sometimes to get sidetracked and to get distracted from our goal. But let's examine a few points along the way here. One of the reasons that we need to do this is that life is short. Life is short. We can't say, well, I'll get to that sometime. Or I'll do that someday. You know, I've seen a lot of calendars, and I've never seen one with someday on it. There's Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, but I've never seen someday on the calendar. What's more, I've never seen a tomorrow on the calendar. Now we know, we say, I'll do it tomorrow, and then Monday morning we wake up and we get about a day and we say, well, you know, I'll do that tomorrow. And so Tuesday morning we get up and, well, I'll do that tomorrow. And you know, tomorrow never comes. It's always today. Every morning when we get up, what do we call it? We say, here we are today. Good morning. We're here today. You know, we're happy to be here today. We're glad God woke us up today. But we never say that about tomorrow. We always are living today. Can't live tomorrow. So when we do need to not do something on the specific day, and there are times when we have to assign something to another time, don't just say tomorrow or sometime or someday. Set a specific day, and that will help us to have something to target, just like an appointment that we might have with the doctor or with any other situation where we have an appointment. If we just say, well, I'll do that sometime. One of the things that they say in many businesses and with the same thing with Bible studies, when you want to set a Bible study with somebody, try to set a day and a time. Now, some people won't. They'll say, well, I'll get back to you. I've had a lot of people say, well, you know, how's Tuesday for you? How about Thursday? But I've had a lot of people say, well, you know, I'll give you a call. You know how many of those people ever gave me a call? Now, see, if you don't set a specific day and time, that's what happens. It just gets pushed off, and they get on about other things. Now, of course, we can't force anybody. We can't say, now, you're going to study at this particular day, at this particular time, about, you know, whatever, I'm going to make you do it, and then go and hold a gun to their head and make them study the Bible. We can't do that. But we need to encourage them whenever we're trying to get a study with somebody to set a specific day and time. Because life is short, and the longer people put things off, the more likely it is that those things will never get accomplished. Job 14, 1 and 2, Job says, man who is born of woman is a few days and full of trouble. He comes forth like a flower and fades away. He flees like a shadow and does not continue. James 4, verse 14 says, our life is like a vapor. He says, you do not know what will happen tomorrow. Well, what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. And then we need to understand, too, the night is coming. John 9, verses 4 and 5, Jesus says, I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no man can work. The time's coming. And then we have to understand as well that death is coming. Ecclesiastes 9 and 10 here talks about the grave where we're all going. That's where we're all headed, to that grave. And that death, when it comes, will end any opportunity that we have. Well, since life is short, we need to be busy working. We will be judged by our works. 1 Peter 1:17. So that if you call on the Father who without partiality judges according to each one's work, conduct yourselves throughout the time of your stay here in fear. We need to realize that God is going to judge us according to our work, not according to what we intended to do. He'll judge us based on our intentions. Now, He does know the intent of our hearts, but it's not our intentions that we're judged on. It's the accomplishment, the work that we do. Well, how many folks make them and say, "Well, you know, God, I intended to obey the gospel. I really did." And to many of those, He'll say, "Depart from me, you workers of iniquity. I never knew you." We've got to understand that it's not what we intend to do, but what we actually accomplish that will count for something. And then we need to understand how important it is not to wait, but to do it now. John 4, verses 34 through 36. Jesus said to them, "My food is to do the will of Him who sent me and to finish His work. Do you not say there are still 4 months and then comes the harvest? Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look at the fields. They are already white for harvest. And he who reaps receives wages and gathers fruit for eternal life, that both he who sows and he who reaps may rejoice together." You know, when it comes to farming or growing a garden or anything of that nature, there are seasons, and sometimes you do just have to wait. And you can't very well go pick the fruit before it's ripe. Well, you can, and they do a lot of times now, and that's why it doesn't taste very good. But you shouldn't. You have to wait till it's ripe to pick it. So the farmer has to wait. But what Jesus is telling us is that in the spiritual world, it's ripe. There is fruit out there falling off the trees, rotting, because we're not getting to it quick enough. He says there's a lot to do. He also told his disciples to pray the Lord of harvest that he might send forth reapers, because there was so much to do. Then, of course, we need to understand that work for the Lord is never in vain. You know, sometimes, how many of you have ever wasted a day working on something? Oh, those are some frustrating days. When you worked all day long and you got to the end of the day and you were no closer to where you wanted to be than when you started. You worked, but there was no proof to show anybody that you'd accomplish anything. But you know, work for the Lord is not that way. Noah preached for 120 years while the ark was being prepared. And you know, at the end of it, I'm sure he could have looked around and said, "I've been preaching all this time, and not a one of these guys is getting on the boat with me. Not one of them. I wasted my time." But he didn't. He did exactly what God had told him to do. When we work for the Lord, it's never in vain. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 58, it says, "Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord." There may be many areas of our life where we may work and work and work and it not accomplish anything. But when we're working for the Lord, it's accomplishing something. God knows that we are working, and He will bless us for that work. And then we need to learn from the ant. Proverbs 6, verses 6 through 11. Solomon says, "Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. Which, having no captain, overseer, or ruler, provide her supplies in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. How long will you slumber, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall your poverty come on you like a prowler, and you need your need like an armed man." Now, if we think about the differences in the grasshopper and the ant, those two creatures that God created have often been used to illustrate the point of how important it is to store up for the winter. The grasshopper goes about and thinks nothing of the winter while the ant is storing up the food. And then when the end of the summer comes, well, you know, those ants aren't going to let that grasshopper move in. It doesn't happen that way. We've got to be prepared. You look at those squirrels out there busily gathering their nuts and storing them away so that they'll have food through the winter. These are animals that God created to teach us a lesson, how important it is to work and to accomplish these things. We need to be busy working because laziness is destructive. Laziness destroys, Proverbs 18:9 tells us. It causes things to decay, Ecclesiastes 10:18 tells us. We see that around us so often. Because of laziness, the building decays, and through idleness of hands, the house leaks. Sometimes it's not your own laziness that causes some of these problems, but the laziness of others, or as he says, they're just the idleness of hands. And we've got a leaking steeple up here in the church building. And it could be repaired. But there's no one working on it. No one's been working on it for 6 or 8 months now. And it's all this time. The idleness. It's not necessarily laziness. We've had several people working hard to try to find somebody that can do that job. And we think we've found somebody now. We're waiting on the insurance company to come back with the funds to do that job. You know, but you see, when nothing is being done, if that continues, as rains like we had last night are going to cause severe water damage. And you think about how many buildings, how many houses decay and rot and they leak and they're water damaged and they wind up being destroyed because of something that at one point started with just a little bitty hole that was leaking. And nobody would get up there with a shingle or with some tar or whatever and patch that hole. We've got to understand just how destructive laziness can be. And it devastates. Proverbs 24:30-34. It talks about the field of the lazy man and the vineyard of the man devoid of understanding. And it was all overgrown with thorns and thistles and nettles. The wall was broken down so that the wild animals could come in there and eat all the fruit that was left. All those things. We need to consider that. The same thing is true of the church. If we're lazy about the church work, it's going to decay. I'm not talking about the building. I'm talking about the church itself. The people. I've seen so many churches that just over a period of years, because no one would do the work, no one would be evangelistic, no one would set a Bible study, no one would invite their friends to church, no one was doing anything. And over the years, those churches were destroyed. It's just a matter of time. Then let us think about this and consider it. If tomorrow never came, if this was the last day that we had on this earth, if we don't wake up tomorrow morning, Monday morning, if tomorrow never came, would I be sorry that I didn't spend more time with those I love? Yeah, some of us might be in that circumstance. I could have had that opportunity. Ecclesiastes 4:8 says, "There's one alone without a companion. He has neither son nor brother, yet there's no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks, 'For whom do I toil and deprive myself of good?' This also is vanity and a grave misfortune." We need to be doing the work, but we need to understand that part of our work as human beings is to forge those relationships that we have with other people. Not just to work and to get gain. So many times, you ask somebody, Well, why are you working that job? Well, to make money. Well, why are you making money? Well, so I can buy food. Well, why do you want to buy food? So I can have something to eat. Well, why do you need something to eat? So I can get to work and be strong enough to work. And it just goes back around and around and around. There has to be a greater goal in your life for your work than just so that you can buy food to eat and work some more. Now, there are times when we understand that's a necessity. You've got to have food to eat and to live and so forth. But there needs to be something more to our lives than just working so we can eat. And that's the one thing that the writer of Ecclesiastes here is talking about. This poor fellow, he's working and working and working and working. He's never satisfied no matter how many riches he has. And he doesn't even think about the fact he doesn't even have any friends. He doesn't have any family. And what's it going to accomplish? If he gets all that money, what's he going to do with it when he dies? There's nothing that would be accomplished with it in his lifetime if he's just storing it up. And when it's the end of his life, someone else is going to get it and take advantage of it. How much better to give of that surplus that we have while we're alive so that we can see the good done with it. If tomorrow never came, would I be sorry that I didn't reach out to more with the gospel? Luke 16, 27 and 28. The rich man said, I beg you therefore, Father, that you would send them to my father's house, for I have five brothers, that he may testify to them, lest they also come to this place of torment. If we died, would we be wishing that we could go back and tell somebody the gospel? Somebody that we didn't tell. Who do you know that you would want to warn about hell or to encourage about heaven? Most of us can probably make a list of names of people that we know that we need to encourage them now. We're not insured tomorrow and they're not insured tomorrow. We need to, as soon as we have opportunity, to get to these individuals. And I know there are many other things that go on in our lives and that, you know, we can't get to everybody today. We understand that. We know that. God knows that. He understands that we cannot tell everybody today. But we need to tell somebody today. And that'll be one less. And then there'll be somebody else that we need to tell. And then somebody else. And we need not ever think that we don't have something that we can someone that we can tell there's some work to do. But if tomorrow never came, would I be sorry that I didn't live more for Christ and less for self? Would I be sorry about that? 2 Corinthians 5:15 says, and he died for all, that those who live should live no longer for themselves, but for him who died for them and rose again. And then if tomorrow never came, would I be sorry that I didn't lay up more treasure in heaven and less on earth? We talked about materialism before. We talked about how wealthy we are in this country, how much we have compared to the rest of the world. And there's no sin in having wealth. Abraham was a wealthy man. Job was a wealthy man. David was wealthy. You know, there were a lot of biblical people who were faithful to God and were wealthy. There's not a sin in and of the wealth itself. But are we laying up treasures in heaven or are we laying up treasures on earth? You know, those cars that we buy that 5 years later aren't worth anything. The food that we spend big dollars on because it's a delicacy of some sort or it's so special, and then it's, you know, it doesn't nourish our bodies any better than some of the cheaper stuff that we could buy. In a lot of cases, the stuff we spend the most money on doesn't have any nutritional value at all. Isn't that right, Alice? We spend a lot of money on things sometimes that just don't accomplish anything. We need to think about when we pass on, are we going to be sorry that we didn't lay up more treasure in heaven? Matthew 6:19 through 21, Jesus says, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." This brings to mind the story of the man who came to heaven. And, of course, as the stories always go, Peter was waiting at the gate to guide him in. And the man walked in with Peter, and he looked, and the first thing he saw was such a magnificent mansion like he had never imagined on earth. And he'd been a wealthy man on earth and lived in a fine house, but he had never even seen a house like this one, not even on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And he saw that house and he said to Peter, "Wow, that's wonderful. I am so glad that I'm going to be able to be here living in heaven. And that's an amazing mansion." And Peter said, "That's not yours." And so they walked on down the street, and all along the street were these fabulous mansions. And they kept walking and walking, and he said, "Well, it's a long way to my mansion." And they kept walking, and he began to notice after they'd walked several blocks that, you know, these mansions, these are still good mansions, but they're not quite as nice as those up there. Maybe those were for the martyrs, and I'll get one of these. And he said, "We're not there yet." And he said, "Keep walking." And they kept walking, and after a while they started getting into houses that weren't much better than what he'd lived in on earth. And he started to say, "Well, that's okay. I enjoyed my house on earth. It was a good house. So if I can get a house like that up here in heaven, that'll be all right." And Peter said, "Keep walking." And they finally started to get into the low-rent district. You know, and some of these houses just didn't look very appealing. And he began to say, "Well, we're going to find something pretty soon. You know, what's going on here?" Finally, Peter pulled him to a stop in front of a cardboard box with a few little rags in it, and he said, "This one's yours." "What do you mean this one's mine? All those fabulous mansions, and you're sticking me in this little cardboard shack?" And Peter said to him, "We can only build your heavenly mansion with what you send us." You see, that's the way it is when someone is rich towards themselves and not toward God. When we build up our treasures here on earth, we'll have a fine life here on earth. Like that rich man in the story of the rich man and Lazarus. Oh yeah, we can have all the best things here. But what will we have there? Because that's where we're going to be living for eternity. As we conclude, we need to think about a couple of things. I want to remind us again, Revelation 22 and verse 12. Jesus says, "Behold, I'm coming quickly, and my reward is with me to give to everyone according to his work." We need to be willing to work and ready, zealous for good works. James 4:17, James tells us, "Therefore to him who knows the good to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin." When we know, "Oh, I ought to be doing such and such, but you know, I think I'll just sit and relax a while." There's not to say that we should never have a time to sit and relax. There will come times to sit and relax. Jesus took naps on the boat. He went off to himself at times. Certainly he slept. He enjoyed meals with his friends and companions. There's nothing wrong with that in and of itself. But sometimes there's something that needs to be done right now, and we need to do it. Perhaps you've heard the story about the man who came looking for a job on the farm. And the farmer said, "Well, what qualifications do you have? Have you ever worked on a farm before? You know, what kind of experience do you have? What can you say?" And the fellow said, "Well, I can sleep when the wind blows." And the farmer thought that was an odd answer, but since no one else had tried to get the job, he said, "Well, we'll try you out for a while and we'll see what happens." Well, it wasn't long before one night a storm rolled in, and the wind began to blow and the lightning and the thunder, and the rain began to fall, and then the hail, and the farmer quickly awoke, and he began to panic and thought, "Oh no, the animals and the crop! I've got to do something." And he jumped up out of bed and went running, and he ran to check everything. And the first thing he did was to he found the farmhand laying there sound asleep. And he ran out and he looked, and he found all the animals had been put up. He found the barn door was closed and such a way that it wouldn't blow open. He found that everything that could have been done had been done. And he went back to the house after having been up for a couple of hours to find that the farmhand was there still sound asleep. And he began to understand then why this man had said, "I can sleep when the wind blows." You do your work in preparation before the wind starts blowing, you can sleep through the storm. Jesus wasn't the slightest bit concerned about that storm on the Sea of Galilee. He was sleeping away. We can have that kind of peace if we know that we're doing all that we can do. "I've been a dead weight many years around the church's neck. I've let the others carry me and always pay the check. I've had my name upon the rolls for years and years gone by. I've criticized and grumbled too. Nothing could satisfy. I've been a dead weight long enough upon the church's back. Beginning now, I'm going to take a wholly different track. I'm going to pray and pay and work and carry loads instead, and not have others carry me like people do the dead." There's plenty of work for everyone. But there are plenty of us to do the work if we work together. Jesus had 12 Galileans, most of whom were fishermen. Most of whom were uneducated. I mean, they didn't even... High school? No. Grade school? Probably didn't ever go to school at all. Couldn't read and write, some of them, probably. But these 12 men, one of whom turned on him and then had to be replaced, but these men turned the world upside down. Well, if 12 people can do that, what can all of us do? We ought to be able to do as much to at least one town, at least one county, at least one area. We ought to be able to do something like that. But the difference between them and us is, I think that sometimes we don't really believe. They believed. They'd seen the miracles and they'd seen Jesus risen from the dead. Well, before they saw Jesus risen from the dead, they were scared, cowering, locked in a house, afraid they were going to be the next ones crucified. But after they saw Jesus risen from the dead, those men were changed. And not even the threat of death could shut them up. We need to get that kind of conviction and that kind of determination and that kind of zeal. And when we do that, the devil won't be able to stop us. The religious world out there won't be able to stop us. The secular world out there won't be able to stop us. And even the dead weights in the church won't be able to stop us. We need to get that kind of zeal. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. Not half-heartedly. If you're here tonight and you have a need to respond to the invitation, whether in initial obedience to the gospel or as a Christian, you haven't been doing what you could or what you should, perhaps you need to respond. And we ask that you do so as we stand and as we sing.